It's Monday, December 6th. You are listening to LA Podcast. I am Scott Frazier, joined this morning by Alyssa Walker and Cerise Castle. Hello to both of you.
Hi.
Hello.
We are going to talk about some really big news in just a minute. But before we get to that, as usual, we have a little bit of housekeeping that we want to get to. We're in the middle of holiday season now. Actually, we just passed Giving Tuesday last week. In other words, it's a great time to think about supporting local independent media. All of our reporting and programming at LA Podcast is a direct product of our member subscriptions. We have really big plans on the horizon in 2022, which is really close at hand now. Suffice it to say, we're very excited and very grateful to have the opportunity to share that with you, all of our plans in the coming weeks and months. If you want to support us the way that Sepulveda pass holders support us, you can go to thelapod.com and click the support us link, or you can go to patreon.com/LA Podcast. We have a variety of other offerings that are supported by Sepulveda pass holders, including LA newsletter, which you can get by going to thelapod.com/newsletter. LA Newsletter is a free once weekly look around at LA County politics with original reporting and editorials from our team. We also have the LA Pod film club show called 30 Mile Zone. We're finishing out the fall season with Noah Baumbach's Marriage Story coming this week and Straight Outta Compton coming in 2 weeks. If you like this show, if you value journalism made in and about Los Angeles, and of course, if you're in a position to do so, please consider giving to our Sepulveda Pass program.
And we have fanny packs.
And yes, we have fanny packs. We're going to have a link to this in our show notes. Sepulveda pass holders, if you go to Patreon or check your inboxes, you should have a message regarding discounted rates available for members. These are going to apply to all of our merchandise, and the fanny packs are the first up. You will love them.
It's the hottest gift this season. I'm telling you.
Alyssa, why don't you start with an LA story this
week? Sure. I have such a delightful LA story.
Does it involve getting cyberbullied? I'm just wondering based on the
not yet. Not yet. That will be next week's story. I talk so much about walking my daughter to school every morning. Both of our kids are lucky enough to take them to school where we can walk them both to school every morning. And I talk a lot about the horrors that we face every day as we try to cross major yeah. streets and poorly marked intersections. And one particular intersection right in front of her school is so big that it's become like a sideshow location where you'll come walk out of school one day and there'll be donuts, like, yeah. you know. So that's a comforting feeling.
One of those places where, like, if you go on Google Earth, yeah, you can, like, see the skid marks.
Yes, exactly. So I was so happy this week to have our neighborhood council get a presentation from the Safe Routes to School program through LADOT. Their school programs for just tightening up intersections and putting in like bollards and bike lanes and roundabouts around schools have been amazing. And they've done, I think, 50 schools or something of LAUSD. And some of them I've written about it. They've just been so impressive. And people really support these and they do such a good job of going in the community. But I was just so, Margot Conyers gave the presentation, who's a pedestrian coordinator who has been running this program. And it's to our neighborhood council, so you expect there to be like some pushback or, you know, I brace, you know, and I wanted to be like a supportive parent and make sure that, like, you know, all the parents are excited that these changes are happening, but you worry about the other people. I have to say, I have never seen a presentation being given by LADOT and have such a positive reaction, in the sense that some of these people were asking for more. They were like, can you put in speed cameras? Can you drop the speed limit even lower?
Yeah.
Can we have protected bike lanes? It was just like a remarkable moment where people were so supportive of these changes. And like one of the things proposed is a scramble on Vermont and 3rd, a intersection that I think we desperately need to have, you know, that scramble treatment, which means you can cross from any corner. They close the entire intersection for people to cross. And they were so excited and had talked about friends that they had known that had been injured, you know, in that. It was just a heartwarming moment. And
you don't get many of those when you talk about LA DOT.
Yeah, shout out to LA DOT and this really great program that is keeping kids safe around their schools. And hopefully we'll be able to expand it with the infrastructure money that we're getting, because that is can be part of it.
Right on. Cerise, LA story this week.
So my LA story is I've been spending a lot of time at the Sunken City lately because I wrote a piece for the LA Times Image magazine about Sunken City and just times I used to have there as a teen smoking pot. And I also dug into just sort of what Sunken City is. And the history behind it. It's LA's biggest ongoing ecological disaster, basically in 1929.
That crown is no joke, by the way.
Yeah, like, I mean, that's a lot.
They don't just hand that out to
there's
anybody.
There's a lot of frontrunners.
Right. Yeah, we have so many ongoing ones. So, like, to be the 100-year-long thing that we've never really fixed, like, yeah, shout out to San Pedro. In any case, Sunken City is a neighborhood that was built without any geological surveying being done, and turns out it was built on really unstable shale. If you go down there, which is technically a crime, so I'm not encouraging you to go down there, but you can access it. There may or may not be a hole in the fence that's very easy to climb through. but you can touch this stuff and it like literally crumbles in your hands. Yeah. When I was down there, I was actually like really scared because like in the course of reporting this, like I did talk to geologists and they were like, yeah, we don't go there. It's, it's going to collapse into the ocean. And in 1929, that's, basically what happened. There was a rainstorm, a water main broke and a huge crack, formed across Paseo del Mar, and the crack continued to grow for the about 6 months. The city told people, ah, nothing to see here. We're nothing to worry about.
Remain in your homes. Wait, was it already inhabited? Like people lived
there.
Wow.
It was a very, it was like the well-to-do neighborhood for wealthy people, really, like grocery store owners. One resident that I was reading about was a producer of Broadway plays and made costumes. So these weren't cheap houses. This was like cliffside views of the beautiful ocean, until one day it just started sliding into the ocean, and it continued to slide into the ocean.
The best view of all.
Yeah.
When you're about to break the waves.
Yeah.
It's wild. So was it like, is this your like first time going back there since you were a teenager?
Yeah, it was. Cool. And it looks basically the same. I mean, the graffiti's different, but it's the same vibe. I was talking to my cousins, one of them is still actually in high school, about it. And I mean, kids are still going there to smoke pot. I mean, that's sort of like what the place has become.
Yeah.
It was once this like really ritzy neighborhood, and now it's like where like like punks and stoners go to like kick it, which I think is pretty cool.
Absolutely.
We need more of those places.
My LA story this week is, I don't know, I've been sort of just stuck at home, and I'm trying to make one of my New Year's resolutions is going to be to leave my neighborhood once a week. I'm basically
it's
like
hard.
A shut-in
it's
at
hard.
This point.
It's hard.
But for now, for the remaining weeks of 2021, my LA story is like I've just been watching this apartment building go up in my. I feel like Emily Dickinson or something. Like I'm just haunting the guest bedroom in my home, and I've been watching this apartment building go up, and it's. I don't know. It's been kind of cool, just like this weird. Weirdly intimate experience where I'm like, oh man, I can see all of these people's apartments, future apartments being built, you know, and I now feel like I have this knowledge of this building. I have this connection with it where I've just been watching it grow each day. I'm going to go over there probably get a tour once it's done and be furious when I like learn how much rent is. I'm sure that that's only several months away, but for now it's been kind of fun. It's been just, I don't know when the last time I had that exact experience was, because I've mostly lived in neighborhoods in LA where literally nothing got built ever, including in downtown where like all the buildings are 100 years old.
Hilarious. Now everything is getting built all the time in LA. And it's causing a lot of traffic.
Yeah.
Which I hate. We don't need more people here.
Trucks around here. Alexis Olivier does all these videos of how the, like, it's either they're taking dirt away or they're bringing cement, or I don't know what they're, I don't know.
We've had,
what are they doing?
They're just trucking shit around. And they don't pick it up. They have a street sweeper sometimes that comes through, but that's very rare. And then the rest of the time, it's just like, there's just stuff everywhere.
And we've also had people coming through and like, I don't know if it's related to the building going in, but they've just been like randomly cutting our power and water.
Oh.
They tell us first, but like literally right before they do it. Oh, nice. Yeah. So I don't know. C'est la vie, I guess. Anyway, let us get into this week's news. We want to start with a story that I think a lot of our listeners are probably already familiar with. Even if you're not a frequent listener of this show, but you just follow local politics, you probably have heard about it, but not in as much detail necessarily as we're about to talk about it. I am talking about, of course, the sexual harassment scandal that has been whirling around LA Mayor, still the mayor, Eric Garcetti. I have to remind myself still every time he comes up. Because, I mean, you wouldn't know it, honestly, unless you were actively looking for confirmation. You just wouldn't be able to tell. So Mayor Eric Garcetti has been dealing with the fallout of a sexual harassment scandal since allegations were made publicly against his longtime aide, friend, confidant, Rick Jacobs. This week, Alyssa, our Alyssa, writing in New York Magazine, her home base, published an in-depth review of the claims using under oath testimony from depositions and from on the record sources about their experiences with Jacobs. It's a really great piece of journalism. Anyone who hasn't read it should. Alyssa, I'm so happy that we can talk about it with you here.
Finally.
Finally. Yeah. Wait, what? This was a product of what? You said 4 months?
I spent 4 months on it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was, I mean, just to speak about the process alone. I mean, I think we've talked about this so many times on the show, and anybody who listens regularly probably knows a lot of the details, but I'll just quickly just go over like what information there is and why I thought there needed to be a story. So as we've talked about many times, there was a lawsuit that was filed in June of 2020. It was made public in July of 2020, and that's when I think we first spoke about it. And it was from a LAPD officer who had served on the mayor's security detail for many years, starting in 2013, and had allegations of sexual harassment against Rick Jacobs, who was the mayor's longtime. It's hard to understate how influential this person is in the mayor's life and his role as mayor. And I think what we've talked a lot about on the show is how much Jacobs really did influence policy. You know, yep. A lot of the things that got done or didn't get done in this city is because it was on Rick's agenda. That was part of what he wanted to do. So things like Measure M is a perfect example. That was something that Jacobs actually took a leave of absence from his role as deputy chief of staff in the mayor's office and ran that campaign along with HHH at the same time. Remember, those were the same election, and got that passed. You know, that's a very like huge, you know, Jacobs achievement.
Can you give us like a refresher of who is this person, and particularly like how did Rick Jacobs end up in Garcetti's orbit? I think you gave a very excellent treatment of that in your piece.
Yeah, I mean, he it was interesting because of all the people that I talked to for my story, and I talked to about 36 people who either worked in or with City Hall, and I think most people knew him and his work best from, he worked at a place called, he actually was the founding chair of this place called the Courage Campaign, like a grassroots organizing progressive nonprofit. And they had been instrumental in bringing down Prop 8, because remember, that was passed by voters, and then they had all these legal challenges. And so that was kind of like a national battle. Yeah. Very, very important historic moment, I think, for civil rights. And, you know, he had been not only working, you know, through California, like, to, you know, get this overturned at the state level, but it required like national, you know, coalition building and making a lot of trips to DC. So he's very well known, you know, not just in LA politics and not just California politics, but nationwide, and had a lot of connections to, you know, people who worked in the White House and people who worked, you know, in Senate offices, things like that. So most people I knew first knew who he was because of that. And that's how I think he, you know, has a long list of people who he works very closely with, including many people that he continues to work with now. And I think that's also
after
important to know. Yeah, I mean, he is, there was a great story in KPCC a couple months ago that he is still being paid by the Carpenters Union, a hugely influential group that, you know, is seeking and often seeks out like the endorsements for political candidates, for example. So, mm-hmm. And a lot of money, donated a lot of money to the mayor's election efforts and other groups, including many that you know, Jacobs had set up for the mayor, which were seen as these like platforms which he could use to run for higher office when he was mulling a presidential run. So we had things like Accelerator for America and the Democratic Midterm Victory Fund, which is a PAC that he set up for him.
I mean, when you talk about his sort of progressive bona fides, Jacobs, I mean, it's actually pretty, it's pretty clear cut in what you wrote. Like, this is a person who was at least statewide and nationally deeply involved in progressive causes. Of course, Proposition 8, I mean, but this is funny because in California, or I guess suppose in national media, we're very accustomed to thinking about California as this very progressive deep blue state. Of course, we're only a decade removed at this point from having a Republican governor and constitutionally defining marriage as between a man and a woman. And it's only the fact that that was overruled by the Supreme Court down the line that is the reason why that is not currently in force here. Jacobs was introduced to First Lady Amy Wakeland before she was First Lady in 2003, 2004, when they were both working on the presidential campaign of progressive Howard Dean. So, like, he just gets more and more embedded into Amy Wakeland and Eric Garcetti's political circle. Like you said, then he ends up running nonprofits for them and spreading the mayor's influence further across the country, right? Like, what is the importance, as far as you've been able to tell, of Rick Jacobs to the political futures of LA's first family? Like, what does he bring to the table for them?
I mean, what I tried to convey, I was trying to, you know, talk about, you know, who he was. And I said, if you know who Eric Garcetti is, it's probably because of Rick Jacobs.
Yeah.
Like, that's the way I describe it, because not every mayor, even of Los Angeles, becomes this sort of media star and is able to kind of, you know, become a surrogate for the presidential campaign, for example. Like, he became like Biden's top campaign co-chair, you know, and was out there making appearances on his behalf, you know, all over the country. I mean, that's something, that's a special role within the Democratic Party, within, you know, even a city politic type of role. So and this was all, you know, from my conversations with people who are familiar with this, is these were Rick's ideas to start that pack, for example, or to, you know, create this Accelerator for America group that was basically just going to small town mayors, not necessarily small, but like smaller. The first event was actually held in South Bend when there was a Mayor Pete there. And it was this idea that you could do things like Measure M, actually. Like that's where the idea came from. It was like, infrastructure coalitions that could get past, you know, big ideas for cities and use, you know, technology in interesting ways. And so it was kind of like grafting the ideas of that had worked in LA, which Measure M was hugely successful. And is something that was always included in the talking points for, say, his higher office aspirations. And like shopping them to other cities and being like, oh, here's an expert on how we do, say, climate stuff. It was a similar thing. Like he became the head of the climate mayors, Mayor Garcetti did, and became chair of C40. These are both like very big and influential coalitions of mayors that have unified around this, you know, we're going to follow the Paris Accord, even if Trump doesn't, kind of thing, and how cities are the front lines for climate change issues.
Yeah, I mean, this is a strategy that has earned him a lot of friends nationally. I'm speaking about Mayor Garcetti, has earned him friends nationally, has also earned him a lot of chagrin locally, not just from this show. Obviously, we've talked a lot about how he has spent more of his time and attention elsewhere than on this city, but other people have noticed that as well. I guess one of the things I'm curious about is like this original reporting about the first reports about the lawsuit that was last summer. It came at a very, very trying time for the city as a whole. We had the pandemic, of course. We had the national movements against anti-Black racism, which Los Angeles saw, I think it's safe to say, its largest demonstrations against anti-Blackness since at least the 90s. If not ever. I'm curious though, because it seems like it sort of came and went, the reporting on this. Did you feel like there was something missing from that conversation, or what prompted you to give a more full examination in your reporting on this story at this point in time?
Yeah, you have to look back and remember that moment, right? We had a lot going on, like news-wise, I think, during that time. And it's easy for a story like
this. There was a presidential election going on, too.
Yeah, I mean, we had bigger problems, you know, we thought, at the time, right? So a lot of people, I think, were like, okay, great, but like, you know, pay attention. But usually these things end up getting settled. You know, in my mind, anytime there's a lawsuit like that, usually just things get settled out of court and you don't really think about them again. But we talked about it in depth at the time. And then Yasher Lee, who was a accuser of Jacobs, said that these incidents happened when he was working for Gavin Newsom. Mm-hmm. During that same period that I was talking about before, about like the Prop 8 years. And he worked very hard to bring a lot of this information to light. And when the depositions began occurring like later in 2020, they started doing discovery on the case. And these depositions were being taken, and some of them would get made public, and there'd be stories on some of the details. And we learned many different things, not just related to this case, but other things about how the city works. But I don't, I feel like there wasn't maybe just one single piece that went through everything and put it all in one place. I think the LA Times and KPCC have done amazing job staying on this story, and they have, you know, been there for all the developments. But I just wanted to put it all in one place because the trial is coming up January 22nd, like this was not settled. You know, this was something that it was, once they knew it was going to go to court, you know, we knew that, you know, these people are going to be on the stand. And I also just really wanted Angelinos to know like what was actually happening. And just be able to just grasp a little bit about what some of these people who, you know, were kind enough to talk to me, and some of them on the record, some of them not, but were very helpful, were just pointing to as a really big, huge problem in our physical, you know, government, and, you know, both as a workplace. And I always like to remind people that City Hall is a place that you work. And some of the people that have enabled, that they say have enabled this type of toxic workplace to be perpetuated.
When you talk about the people that you spoke to and whose accounts you rely on in your reporting, one of those is Naomi Seligman, who was formerly the director of communications in Mayor Eric Garcetti's office. You actually open with an account of the 2016 State of the City speech that he gave while it was widely rumored that he was considering a run for governor or senator or president. And following that speech, which was written by Seligman, she says that she was forcefully kissed by Rick Jacobs. Could you maybe just like walk our listeners through her account of what happened and how it made her feel?
And again, this was a story that had been in a deposition that had been reported on. And, you know, I was just very curious because there were a few people in the depositions that seemed to be telling about a certain type of culture happening at City Hall. And then there were other depositions that seemed to be not, you know, saying the same types of things about how City Hall worked. And Naomi's was one of them that I was really curious about. She was in her office with members of her staff, and Jacobs came into the room. They just had this great, successful speech. And yeah, he pinned her arms to her side, as she says, and like really tightly grabbed her and kissed her on the lips and then wouldn't let go. Mm-hmm. And this is something that other people have said happened to them that told me this and has also been reported elsewhere. It was another person that spoke to me on the record, Amanda Crumley, who worked with Jacobs during the Prop 8 years, said that she had also been kissed on the lips by him very hard, I think is how she described it. So this was something that multiple people told me happened to them, and men and women. And when it happened to Naomi, she said she went to the next room and reported it to Ana Guerrero, who was the chief of staff at the time for the mayor. And that was something that she actually denied occurring. She said that it was not reported to her, and it didn't happen.
I the story, as it's written, ran under a headline, which is a quote, "The mayor knew," that comes from an anonymous former city employee that you spoke with. And that person is referring to their own mistreatment by Jacobs in a variety of settings and also just generally about Jacobs' conduct. I think one of the things that's really important to pin down here, because you spoke to so many people for this story and you read a lot of sworn testimony, it seems like the recurring theme, if I can draw this out, is that people both inside the administration and outside of it, you mentioned your conversation with Crumley, you mentioned the Seligman testimony. It seems like there is a lot of, generally speaking, agreement that either Garcetti knew about or should have known about this type of behavior that a variety of people allege was taking place. The main exceptions, as you mentioned, there's Ana Guerrero, former chief of staff. Then there is Garcetti's administration as a whole, which officially has given the statement that he was unaware of any of this conduct and would have taken action if he had been aware of it. I guess the consensus is Garcetti should have known. Like, there's not a way that he could have been around Jacobs that as often as he was and not have observed these things or been told.
I think going back to the quote you said from the former city employee that says he was harassed for years by Jacobs, both in, you know, a variety of settings. I think, you know, what they said was so striking that just like you couldn't be in these places and not know that this is what was going on. And in some cases, he was, you know, one or two people away within eyesight, and these things were happening. And it's just something that was well known to the people who were at, you know, in these rooms. These, and one thing that's really important to note is the reason that, for example, you know, Garza, the LAPD officer, was the subject of this is because a lot of this happened when they were on these trips.
Right.
And sometimes going places where the public did not know where the mayor was. I mean, you remember, we've talked about this on the show. We would just get these emails that would say, you know, the mayor is leaving the state for 4 days. And what people who worked on his staff at the time said was sometimes they did not know because Jacobs was in charge of the schedule, right? And was booking trips.
They didn't know where the mayor was.
And they would get an Instagram or something from someone and say, wait, oh, he's in Iowa or whatever, right? Like, you know, and so what Garza says in his complaint and in his depositions, which are incredibly difficult to read. I mean, I read over 2,000 pages of testimony and I had to like stop and close the computer and cry a few times because if this is what's happening to city employees, to, you know, people who wanted to do good things for this city, it was pretty heartbreaking to hear some of these stories and the people I spoke with as well. But a lot of the harassment that Garza alleges was happening on these trips where we didn't have itineraries for, and at one point, the LA Times sued the city to get information on where these trips were and how many security detail was going with them. And Garza says that the out-of-town trips were the worst part of that. That was when the harassment intensified. So that to me was extremely troubling to hear those allegations.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny when we think about how difficult it is to actually pin down and prove what somebody knew at a certain point, which so much of this story has focused on what was Garcetti aware of and when should he have been aware of it. To the extent that we have previously reported on, and the LA Times first published a photo, I believe, from one of these depositions that was that showed Rick Jacobs making a grabbing gesture towards a man's crotch while Eric Garcetti was too people away, giving a double thumbs up gesture, and he essentially just said, "I didn't see that." It's very hard to disprove that. You speak about that in your reporting as well, but there's also a considerable amount of new reporting in here. Like, you spoke with people. Am I correct in thinking you spoke with people who had not previously given on the record testimony about this case, and you also have information including the substance of text messages that were exchanged by Garcetti and the Garcetti family, really, and Rick Jacobs after the allegations became public. What was in the text messages that was so important?
Yeah, I mean, these were both introduced as evidence in discovery. One is a WhatsApp message from the mayor to Jacobs, and it's dated the day after the suit was made public. And I want to note that Jacobs knew that the suit was being filed because he was given a tip from Gil Garcetti, who was the former DA for LA County and Eric's father. So he knew what was coming, and that helped alert the both him and the mayor's office to what was going to happen. But this is the day after it was made public, and the mayor says to Jacobs, "I'm sorry for the bright light. It sucks. How are you doing?" And Jacobs responds that he's made a lot of calls and texts, had good conversations, and one of them to Anita. And he says in his testimony, Jacobs says in his testimony that Anita is Anita Dunn. who's a top Biden strategist, very well known person, and at the time was working on the campaign for him. So in that, if you go back to remind what we were doing in July 2020. And she's also well known for giving informal damage control advice to Harvey Weinstein before he was exposed in the New York Times for his sexual harassment allegations. And, you know, that had not been reported on previously. And then the other text is from Gil Garcetti to Jacobs, again, expressing his, you know, sorrow for this happening and saying, we are with you, from him and his wife. So those were both sent the day after this was made public, in July 2020. And it would be about 4 months until that photo was public that you were talking about, that you would hear the mayor say anything negative about Jacobs at all. When the photo finally came out, that was in November, a year ago, and that's when he finally said, these actions are inappropriate. This person does not represent me.
Hasn't represented me for years.
Since he left the mayor's office, right? But I mean,
that glosses over a huge period of time where they were clearly incredibly close, right, including up to the point where the allegations became made public. I think lastly touch on, you brought up Anita Dunn, who was working as was Mayor Garcetti to get Biden elected. Obviously, you can't really speculate on what those conversations were about, but is there any clear evidence at this point in time? Because I think one of the biggest implications of this story is the mayor, whether or not he knew about this harassment and the alleged harassment and abuse taking place in his office, of which this is only one of the sort of smoking stories that we have along those lines. There have been other people involved in his administration, including the former chief of staff Guerrero, who have been accused of either disrespectful or inappropriate workplace conduct. So there is sort of like this sense of it's in the air at City Hall. I guess my last question about this is, when we talk about whether or not he knows about the kind of environment he works under, it does seem like it has a bearing on his next office, right? The proposed elevation of Eric Garcetti to head up the embassy in India. And is there any sign outwardly that we're aware of that the Biden administration or senators in Congress have taken any of this information as a sign that Garcetti might not be fit for this role? Have they responded? I think from my perspective, the Anita Dunn comment sort of reads like it is a sign that Biden is sticking with Garcetti. And of course, the fact that that came last year, he has stuck with him up till this point, so that it sort of matches up. But what is the Biden administration, if anything, saying about this case?
Yeah, a statement from the White House, a spokesperson at the White House, was basically the same as the one that they gave the LA Times when the nomination was announced. So that was July of this year. That was just like, the mayor has always said he never, you know, had awareness of this, and he would have stopped it. And then for our statement to us, they did tag on, like, President Biden is completely confident in Garcetti's abilities to be in India. And I will note something else that we reported for the first time is that Naomi had written a letter to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, really just outlining her experiences in City Hall and that of others in depositions that has been sent to these senators. I assume they read their mail. maybe like a staffer reads it and then kind of files it. But from what I understand, you know, the vetting process is done for this this office, this appointment. And it's just a matter of time of scheduling the hearing.
Confirmation hearing.
Yeah, I don't know if something has changed or will change. You know, I will just say that I feel like the statement from the White House was very like adamant that we are sticking with the appointee.
Do you think this is, sorry, I know they said that was the last one. Do you think this is the end of the road for this story, or are you going to, do you have more reporting that you are planning for this?
I will say that since this story has been published, multiple people have reached out to me to say that they were also harassed by Jacobs. And like I said, this case is going to court. It was not settled. There was a decision. There could have been a settlement. And the city attorney has decided to pursue this. We asked a question, Matt Tinoco asked a question to the mayor a few weeks ago about the independent investigation that the city ordered from this independent firm. And John Peltz, who we mention every week on this show, confirmed with the city attorney that they have the legal ability to release it, but they are not releasing it. So we have this independent investigation, and we don't know what's in it. And I will also say that some of the people that I talked to for my story were not interviewed for that independent investigation. So that's something else to follow up on, you know, for someone to...
Well, I know a thing or two about independent investigations.
Yeah, we talked about that before. a decent outcome, of course. And then, yeah, the trial starts next month. So I hope people are paying attention to this more. And there's a lot more to be discussed. And I also hope the depositions are made public because... I think people need to see what's been going on in City Hall.
Next up this week, we want to talk about homelessness. Recent days have brought us new reporting about how the unhoused have fared during the pandemic, and also how primarily housed Angelenos are currently viewing the crisis, how views are changing. So first, a new report from a cross-disciplinary group calling themselves the After Echo Park Research Collective, which includes UCLA researchers, as well as activists participating in direct action, and members of a group called UTACH, Unhoused Tenants Against Carceral Housing. Is that how you pronounce it? I believe it is. Sam Levin of The Guardian wrote up the findings of their report, which is titled, "We Do Not Forget Stolen Lives of LA's Unhoused During the COVID-19 Pandemic." We've put links to both Levin's report as well as the report itself into our show notes this week. It's authored by Professor Ananya Roy of UCLA and Chloe Rosenstock of Streetwatch LA. The top line finding here is that as many as 1,500 unhoused people have died during the course of the COVID-19 pandemic in public places, and potentially another 418 died in hotels and motels. The report is quick to note that it's difficult to say how many of these people were in fact unhoused or recently unhoused at the time of their deaths, just because that data is not really kept in such a way that those folks can easily be identified. In fact, I think our most common way of identifying people who are unhoused is by asking them, and you can't do that when people have passed on. Alyssa, how do you react to that number? Right, we're talking about like nearly 2,000 people dead, a large number of whom were likely unhoused. We're talking, so for more specifics, the report looks at coroner's findings of people who died in circumstances where they were potentially at bus stops, on sidewalks, in addition to, as I mentioned, in hotels and motels. So there is, I think, a likelihood, but not a certainty, that those folks were housing insecure at the time of their death. Like, how do you grapple with the scale of that, I guess.
I think what I was most shocked, the number that I was most shocked by was the number of people who died in shelter, you know, in hotels and motels, especially as Project Room Key was promoted as this huge solution for preventing deaths, you know, mm-hmm. during a pandemic. And a lot of stories that we've heard about Project Room Key, you know, from UTACH is one of the best sources of people who had stayed in some of these hotels and motels and were denied things like towels. You know, I mean,
I'll never forget that woman who brought that giant paper towel to a protest and demonstrated that that was what they were giving people
right.
to use. It's like so...
Yeah. To dry after showers yeah. and things like
and
that.
And the woman that I spoke with for my Venice story, who had been one of the people who was moved off of the beach and got into housing, had fallen out of Project Room Key because she was not allowed to stay in the room with her son, who, you know, is they didn't allow, I guess, opposite sex of family members in the same room. And she has low vision and had a lot of trouble, you know, navigating around her room without the help of her son mm-hmm. and was not able to be given any kind of special, you know, help or an exception or something. And they ended up leaving and going back to the beach because of it. So you look at some of these stories and you say, well, you know, that could lead to depression, suicide, you know, there's all, you start to see how these could spiral out of control. That number just really struck with me that we weren't guaranteeing someone's survival just by getting them inside in some of these situations.
I mean, it's interesting, like it is hard to know when they're looking at this data. One of the difficulties that they flagged with trying to parse who was and who wasn't homeless was that the county has not really, or the county and the city, both of which are part of the implementation of Project Room Key, haven't been straightforward about releasing locations that are part of the Project Room Key program. They have mostly withheld the addresses and names of hotels and motels that are participating. So they say, in the interest of protecting the privacy of both the unhoused residents and the businesses. I mean, given that, it is somewhat difficult to say what percentage of those 418 people who they found passed away in hotels and motels were housing insecure or unhoused. But I mean, at least as you compare it with somebody who dies of a drug overdose underneath a freeway overpass, I think is almost certainly, it's not 100%, but it's probably pretty close to that likelihood that they are living unhoused. Somebody who dies of a drug overdose in a motel, I'd say the odds are lower, although still probably pretty good knowing the situation that we're going through here in Los Angeles. But yeah, like for Project Room Key, where we can't really say that these deaths are mostly or even in large part happening at Project Room Key sites based on this data, it is, I think, a concern that you and one that apparently Lhasa is aware of, as Heidi Marston was the only official who actually responded, apparently, to Sam Levin when he was reporting on this. Not sure who else he reached out to, but she said that, you know, that there definitely have been people who have died during the Project Room Key program. The LA Times has reported to that effect as well, on one site in particular. So, I mean, Marston's point, which she makes in the quote to Sam Levin, is that the Project Room Key has also saved people's lives, but also just generally speaking, that as a result of having been homeless, which I think is fair to say, people are not in good physical health, generally speaking, even when they're brought indoors, and it is, you know, it's not certainly not a guarantee that they just bringing them indoors will make them healthy enough to be able to survive, because this is a condition that really radically harms people. That being said, I was actually pretty surprised that nobody else commented on this report whatsoever. Okay, well, tell me about that, right?
Honestly, I mean, in this city, whenever you're going to be reporting on something that's going to make people look bad, of course they're not going to talk to you. Like, they send a cease and desist letters. That's how the city operates.
It's just like, this is something that our elected officials say that they spend more of their time working on than anything else. And so it just seems like, you know, I mean, like, okay, so this group, the After Echo Park Research Collective, in its name, it takes its name, of course, from the shutdown, the violent suppression of a homeless encampment at Echo Park Lake, which was undertaken by one of the 15 city council members with apparently the support of multiple other city departments. So like, and Street Watch, which I have donated a fair amount of time to in the past, is also a group that the city does not look upon favorably. But that being said, like, there's a clear interest, I would think, if you're a politician and like actually making an attempt to say something about this data, even if it's like, I don't think that this is right, it would seem like you have a like some sort of duty to represent that the city is aware of and cares about this issue. But instead, what we kind of get is just like a wall of silence.
Yeah, maybe in the past they would do that, but
right,
not in this current climate.
Yeah, I mean, like, okay, so let's talk about the current climate, because I mean, there's something else that we wanted to talk about from this week, which is a poll that came out from the Los Angeles Business Council. I think it was jointly produced with the Los Angeles Times, and it follows up on a poll 2 years ago. The big finding out of this that everyone is talking about, reporting about, is that Angelenos think that homelessness is the biggest problem in the city. They're sort of split on whether or not they believe it is a quality of life issue, namely a quality of life issue affecting them as house people, or if they think it is a problem that they are actually worried that they will fall into. And I like, is this different than 2 years ago? Is it, we have a lot of really good charts demonstrating that homelessness is the number one problem as people perceive it in the city. That's been that way for a while, right? Am I correct in thinking that?
I thought it was interesting that like being worried about housing affordability had jumped up. I doubt that would have even been part of the top two in, you know, until recently. The precarity that renters are facing in the city has only grown and been, you know, not just magnified by the pandemic, but it's gotten so exponentially bad over the last few years. But you would think that would translate into higher empathy for people who have already found themselves in that situation. And I mean, you do have to look at it, though, the other way. Everybody was like 4 in 10 said that people being unhoused near them made them feel less safe. And then the other figure was that 4 out of 10 had also either experienced homelessness or knew someone who had. But you have to look at it the other way. Like 6 out of 10 people do not think that homeless people are making them feel unsafe in their neighborhoods, which
that's a pretty big figure.
I thought, of course, it's going to be reported the other way. but then you look at, you kind of fit those numbers together and then you have like a 60-40 split. Like
when I think about like what has changed between between now and 5 years ago when we voted on H and HHH, we talk a lot, like I actually worry that maybe we talk too much about like the administrative failures of H and HHH as opposed to something that I think is really becoming increasingly apparent, which is just that LA has seen a huge surge in inequality. Like, I mean, we talk a lot about as a nation, the inequality that has stemmed from the pandemic, but like as a city, there's not a ton of discourse about it. It's really the case that some proportion of Angelenos have seen their personal wealth or stability of their situation increase tremendously to the point where they're saying, you know, I can do what I want. I can go where I want in this city without having to worry about losing my job, without having to worry about losing my home, any of that stuff. for a significant proportion of the city, the opposite is true. And their insecurity and in their ability to stay in their homes has been eviscerated by the pandemic. I mean, we're talking now, you know, now like we're at the early stages of talking about the Omicron variant and stuff. And it's like, you know, the people who are the people who are most going to suffer, if that indeed pans out to be something that results in another wave of business closures, are going to be people who work service jobs, people who work you know, with kids or in care facilities. And those are the type of service jobs that have suffered throughout the pandemic. Those people are more, not less, likely to become. So you see, like, I get that we see this surge in people who are who have either been housing insecure over the last year or know somebody who has, because honestly, if you're living within a certain income level in the city, that seems like it's almost unavoidable at this point, right? But at the same time, like, it, I think that people become less empathetic because they, for a lot of people, they can no longer see this as something that might happen to them. Now it is mm-hmm. just purely like a quality of life problem. I see somebody who is poor.
Right. And that upsets me.
How
dare you?
I thought, I don't, you know, like I don't actually usually read the editorial pages of the Times like at
all. You shouldn't.
But I read one the other day that I wasn't like thrilled about the overall heft of it. It was by Erica Smith, who was checking in with somebody who that she'd previously talked to at La Bayona. But one thing I was like finally happy to see acknowledged in the pages of the Times was that homelessness is about poverty. I would love to see that.
Radical, like, I know, right? Discovery.
I mean, it's like the bar is pretty low, and I would love to see politicians acknowledge that in particular. Like,
I mean, they only just figured out that they can actually interview unhoused people.
That story did not have interview actually with anyone that lived in that area that they were talking about. It was just the advocate for the advocate.
Yeah. But as far as I can tell, like, that seems to just get completely talked around, especially in our political discourse. And so like when there's a conversation about who is homeless or like what is a quality of life issue, it's not ever presented in terms where it's like there is abject poverty on LA city streets and we should do something about that. It's always much more along the lines of this is a mess and somebody needs to take responsibility for removing this mess from my line of sight, which is...
we're talking about like people's lives.
Yeah, people's lives. Absolutely. The thing is that I think the average person has an understanding of that, and the polling data supports that people think of homelessness as being a result of poverty, which maybe isn't surprising because so many people in this city are living not necessarily at the federal poverty line, but at a reasonable scale for the cost of living here in California would be considered in impoverished conditions. But that doesn't really trickle up into the discussions that are, I think, found in reporting and certainly not in political conversation by our elected officials nearly frequently enough. We have more to get through. We want to talk about a story that has huge impacts for the future of Los Angeles. You may have heard.
Literally.
You may have heard. Yes.
We're
getting very existential. There's a story that it may become common in coming decades as a result of climate change that the Sierra Nevada mountains will cease to have snow either year round or for significant parts of the year. Cerise, what does that mean for? What does that mean for me, the water drinker really bad, in Los Angeles?
The thing is, it's really bad, Scott. The study was done by Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and it projected by the late 2040s. So that's not too.
I hate that. That's far not away. Too far away.
Coming right up.
That the Sierra will likely have low or no snow. Low snow, they say that is it within the lower 30th percentile of the historic peak, and no snow is 10 or lower. We got a little preview of what that looks like in 2015 during this massive drought that we had. I'm sure you all remember people were not washing their cars. You were spooning your toilet, I think you shared.
Bucket flushing.
There you go. Still don't know what that is.
Spooning your toilet. That gives me a very different.
You put a bucket in your shower, let it fill up, and then you dump it in the toilet basin, and that causes the toilet to flush instead of using the water from the tank.
Smart. Okay.
Yeah.
So do that. So start doing that again.
So yeah, start doing that because yeah, by the late 2050s, yeah, it could be 10 years without snow.
Snowpack is where just all of LA's water comes from. Is
pretty that- much.
So this isn't just something that's like, oh, skiers would have to do without.
Right. No, it's not just skiing. I mean, yes, this would have a significant impact on the skiing industry, but it would also leave the state without spring and summer melt-off, which is what fills our streams, our rivers. It supports our wider ecosystem. It's where we get our food. And it's where, like you said, Scott, it's where we get a good chunk of water in this state. Right now, we're at about 55% of the melt-off is gone, which isn't great.
Yeah.
State officials are saying that runoff efficiency is at about 20% compared to where it usually stands at this time of year, which is 60. So still not great.
Well, yeah.
But yeah, things are pretty dire. One example of that here in LA County, where we're not seeing that runoff that is so badly needed, is in the Dominguez Channel, where it's been stinky.
Right.
And we've spent about $54 million so far, according to Mark Pastrella of the LA County Department of Public Works. The stink is, of course, being caused by the high levels of hydrogen sulfide, which is being released by the dying plants.
Like rotten egg smell.
Yeah.
Great.
It's not great. Pastrella said it'll take $143 million to make that smell go away, but we still won't have any water. So more smell throughout the county.
Wow. Right,
so all the time.
We had no rain November since the first time since the actual song November Rain came out. So yeah. It was 1992.
No November rain.
November rain for no rain November.
For and the first time since this song came out. That's a funny fact.
I learned that from Robin Petering, who has a podcast about Guns N' Roses. But there's also, like, usually by this time of year, I can see the mountains from my front porch and there's no snow.
And they're snow capped, yeah.
Yeah. So I keep saying I take pictures of the snow on the mountains so I can show my kids that year when there won't be any snow anymore. And I believe fully that that will be true, at least for our mountains, that we will have no snow very soon. I mean, I remember interviewing Bill Patzert, who's like the JPL. He was always like the El Nino guy.
Oh, yeah. I miss that guy.
Yeah, he's retired now, but he comes around now again. I just remember being like, will it ever snow again in the LA Basin? He was like, no. No.
It's been 75 years.
And I just kind of laid down on the floor. And yeah.
Climate change is very real. It gives me a ton of anxiety.
Yeah. The end.
And with that.
I mean, yeah, it is. I mean, just like when we talk about the Carson Channel, right? Like in the Dominguez Channel, it's $150 million almost to remediate a disaster caused
by humans.
And relatively speaking, a minor disaster.
Yes.
Caused by climate change.
Yes.
Like
yes.
We're just going to start seeing these things happen
right.
More and more frequently. Our last big topic that we want to talk about today is about guns. There has been an enormous amount of reporting recently to accompany the breathless coverage of them. I can call it breathless because I think the governor talking about robberies at Louis Vuitton and other high-end stores as like terror in the streets, I believe is a direct quote from his comment that he gave to a newspaper. Seems a bit breathless to me, but there has been a lot of coverage about the growing concern about crime levels in California. One of those, the LAPD frequently brings up the issue of ghost guns. Cerise.
Yes.
What is a ghost gun?
Huh. I'm so glad you asked. I got one right here. No. Imagine if I did. a ghost gun is a gun that you can build yourself. I may or may not have some firsthand knowledge of this, but you can get the parts from a 3D printer or you can order them online from Amazon. And it's pretty easy to put it together. You can look up instructions like on YouTube or other websites, which I won't name. But you really don't need any experience or any particular knowledge to be able to put it together. These guns aren't serialized, which is what makes them so-called ghosts. Because, you know, most guns, if you non-ghost guns, when you buy them, they have a serial number and that serial number is very easily traceable through spent casings of bullets that are fired. And that's how they solve crimes. Long story short,
right.
These ghost guns, they don't have that. So when you fire it, you don't know where it comes from.
Right. So you have, like, for example, when LAPD or whoever finds a gun, they have the ability to say this gun was sold at this gun dealership or whatever. Like, they can basically trace where the gun came from originally.
Right. You can find like some chain of custody behind a gun. Yes.
And so with all of the LAPD and the reporting around, the scrutiny around the issue of ghost guns locally, why is it particularly a cause for concern at this time? Like, is it just that 3D printers are more prevalent now? Is it a political play? What is behind this, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, personally speaking, ghost guns have been like around for like almost 10 years now, maybe longer. Like some gun people can correct me. But I mean, generally, yeah, when we are hearing about them, it's politicians getting up in arms and saying that they are this huge danger that we all need to be panicked about.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, I know several law enforcement officers that own ghost guns. So, yeah, put that in your cap and think about it.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess it's interesting, too, because this seems like it's a new spin, but not necessarily like a new problem.
Right.
Like, they're... As long as serial numbers have been around on guns, people have been like filing them off, right? Like,
yes.
That's something you can do.
Yeah. And the record keeping for a gun, like even if it is serialized, like it's not perfect. People quote unquote lose guns. People steal guns. People sell guns and don't keep meticulous records. That happens all the time.
Right. So now, as you mentioned, we have the politicians taking a look at this. LA City Council has banned a whole host of activities surrounding the ownership or transfer of ghost guns. Functionally, you cannot have them in the city of LA anymore. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, well.
But, I mean, you really can't have a gun in the city of LA? Like,
right.
So
it's kind of just like restating that.
Yes.
I mean, it's like now we're basically making again a political statement that this is something that needs attention at a different level. The city of LA does this quite frequently, actually, where they'll take an action and also say some higher authority needs to weigh in on this issue. But because you mentioned the potential, at least, that law enforcement officers in LA own illegal ghost gun, now illegal ghost guns.
Recently, yes.
We had we had another story about something illegal happening with guns at the, let me make sure I get this right, the Los Angeles Police Rifle and Athletic Club. Is that the correct acronym? LAPRAC?
You got it.
Mm. Where the coffee shop is?
I don't love it.
In You've Elysian been Park? There? Well, you the coffee shop in Elysian Park, right? Is that where it is or is it somewhere else?
It is by the police academy, if that's where it is. Yeah. I'm not sure. I haven't been to the, I've been to the little bandstand above where the academy is. Okay, yeah. So there was a story in the LA Times that was wild, I think is the appropriate term, where somebody was working the sales counter, basically, at the at LAPRAC, which is just a terrible acronym. I don't know why I'm going to keep saying that. But as long as that person never went on vacation, they could continue cooking the books and making it look like inventory was there, when in fact that person allegedly was stealing guns and selling them in a black market gun ring
to other police officers.
Okay, what is happening here? So we
business have, as usual.
we have the Los Angeles Police Department. They are selling guns to just to cops, and a sworn officer of the LAPD is accused of taking those guns and then reselling them at like cut rate prices to other officers, basically.
Essentially, yeah. And the other thing I want to note is, like, yes, this is a wild story, but this isn't anything new. Mm-hmm. You know, just like getting ready for this, I just like did like a quick like cursory search of like other stories. And there are headlines dating back to at least the early 1980s of LAPD officers stealing guns from evidence, from a number of places and selling them to each other. Most recently, I remember reporting on this when it happened was in September of 2017. You may recall there was a scandal with the cadet program, which is where they bring youth between the ages of, I believe it's 14 to 20, to train as a police officer. And yep. It came out that there were missing vehicles, missing equipment like guns.
Statutory rape.
I'm getting to that.
Oh, sorry,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get there ahead of you.
Yeah, but basically things were missing at the 77th Division. And seven cadets were arrested. And then, as you mentioned, yes, it came out that one of the officers supervising these cadets had been sexually assaulting a 15-year-old girl that was in the program. It was discovered when they raided his house that he had a cache of 100-plus weapons, that some of which were illegally modified. LA Times really didn't follow up on where they came from. But yeah, I mean, police officers coming upon guns in unusual circumstances that are probably illegal and involving like their own evidence lockers or gun shops. Yes, it happens all the time and has happened all the time for the past 30 years or 40, because that's the 80s. Yeah.
Oh, that's painful. Yeah, that it was 40 years ago in the 80s. This is, this is part of a culture. It seems like the prosecutors were alarmed, I guess, at least according to this document, by what they found in terms of the gun culture within the department. And is it in terms of just the lack of precautions? Honestly, the fact that you could have a person working a counter like this, and just as long as they say everything's all good, no one finds out that there's a bunch of stock missing is really troubling, especially when LAPD, most honestly, if you look at their social media, they're almost their entire presence is we're taking guns off of the street. And now you have literally their like official gun stores potentially being used I mean, yeah, to sell stolen property to police officers, that's very bad. But also to who else? Like, you know, like right. There's just like a black market gun operation putting guns back on the street when really like that is the main thing that they like to say that they're doing is taking guns off of the street. I don't understand like how something like this could go on for, especially if you're talking about it being... where did these cops think that they were getting the guns from, I guess, is another question. Did they think this was on the up and up? It seems hard to believe.
I doubt it. I recently had a conversation with a law enforcement officer who was sharing with me their thoughts on this story. And they told me that they were speaking hyperbolically, but they said that police officers buy at least 100 guns a year. I asked for clarification and they said 4 to 5. I asked them if it mattered where the guns are coming from. And they said no, that this story was really just like scratching the surface of what's going on with how guns are acquired.
Wow. I mean, this is definitely a story that I think we're going to be following for as long as it goes on, because it is right at the intersection of how policing goes on in public versus what policing gives the license to law enforcement officers to do.
And as they are issuing tactical alerts to allow law enforcement officers to pursue these violent crimes and creating new task forces for, you know, people who are being assaulted and robbed, apparently. Just an interesting, way of introducing more mayhem to the streets that they might investigate.
We will definitely be following up on that, like I said. That is it for this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been episode 203 of LA Podcast. Thank you, Cerise and Alyssa, for joining me. And everybody who is listening to this, we will be back next week. Thank you. Bye.